Good afternoon. This is William Evans, and we're shifting gears. Our guest today is Bob Goff, speaking with us from Rosebud, South Dakota. He's the Secretary of the Intertribal Council on Utility Policy, CU. Thanks for speaking with us, Bob.
Good afternoon. We've been experiencing the very mild winter and surprisingly warm spring that most people have across the country under a climate-changing weather pattern.
It is beautiful, and yet it's a little worrisome when you realize everything here is a month, 6 weeks ahead of time, it seems like.
Indeed.
What's the status of renewable energy in America today?
Well, renewables have a tremendous potential for the U.S. We could certainly meet most of our new energy growth with renewables and energy efficiency. In fact, we could probably reach, for the West, most of our energy growth with 85% energy efficiency and then the remainder with renewables. So we needn't press further with fossil fuels, certainly throughout the West. But nationally, I'd say about 35% of the new energy growth within the last decade has been met with renewable energy. So it's beginning to realize some of that potential, even though it's not had the benefit of the kinds of consistent incentives that our fossil fuel energy sources have enjoyed over the past 50 to 100 years.
From my perspective, it looks worrisome in the sense that it really not getting the support it needs, and shale gas is just sweeping the country like a tsunami.
Well, you've got the benefit of a long entrenched vested interest, very well heeled, and not willing to give up their control over our energy economy. And they're willing to risk our nation's water supply in pursuit of maintaining that control.
And so it's a time for you to continue to just do what you're doing and stay courageous?
Stay courageous. I appreciate that. The Intertribal Council on Utility Policy is, as you know, we represent 15 tribes in the Northern Great Plains, and that is a place where courage has always been demonstrated by the indigenous community in protecting their homeland fiercely and competently. And the energy area is no exception. The 15 tribes in CU together formed part of an energy plan that Intertribal CU developed in the year 2002. And that plan won the World Clean Energy Award for Courage in 2007 in Basel, Switzerland. And it was basically a plan to utilize the vast wind resources on the Great Plains that are distributed over six states, and utilizing the lands and the resources of the reservations in those six states to provide a renewable energy economy and employment in a clean, green economy to Indian people, we could basically displace most of the coal that is currently on the grid, or at least has been for the last over the last decade. The power grid in this region in the Great Plains was built by the federal government, Bureau of Reclamation, off of the dams on the Missouri River and its tributaries, and that those grids were designed to carry, and did carry for a while, 100% hydropower. During the drought that we saw this past decade, we were up to about 85% coal, lignite coal, on that grid. And this is the most carbon-intensive energy in the country. Lignite is a very young coal, so you have to burn a whole lot of it to get the same energy out of it. And that coal underlies the Great Plains here and is a filter for rainwater to provide groundwater in the Oglala Aquifer and elsewhere that is far cleaner. So coal is providing an ecological service here in the ground where we live, and our policy now is actually to get as much of it out of the ground as possible and put it back into the sky, burning it for our cheap energy policy. So our cheap energy really is quite costly, but we have not counted all the costs in terms of its ecological services for keeping the water clean or for the pollution and carbon dioxide climate-changing gases we release to the atmosphere. We'd like to replace that with a new industry here that can bring a whole new economy to one of the poorest parts of the United States, the Northern Great Plains, based on clean energy. The wind resources here are tremendous. We could meet most of the country's electricity needs from the wind in Indian Country and across the Great Plains.
And what's in the way of your doing that, Bob?
Entrenched interests, the rules of the road, of the grid, and of the economics have been written by the vested interests, the coal companies, the hydropower system. Basically now cannot meet the full extent of the energy demand for the region, so alternative energies, additional energy sources beyond hydropower are needed. And in the 70s, that's when coal development really started to grow here in the Northern Plains, in Montana and Wyoming, North Dakota, basically just open pit mine and load dirt, black dirt, lignite coal, into power plants and produce a very inexpensive energy. If you're just simply burning dirt, the costs are pretty low for that piece of the process. But that piece of the process and the payments we make in our, what we call our light bills, do not anywhere near reflect the cost of that carbon going into the atmosphere, the particulates, the NOx and SOx and the like. And particularly now, as we come to recognize carbon dioxide as a greenhouse gas, climate-changing potential, we have unearthing millions of years of sequestered carbon and reactivating it back into the atmosphere. We don't have to account for that in our business plans, in our economic models, but it is certainly accounted for by nature. And nature has no mercy. She doesn't care out of your business plans. She's doing the actual cost accounting on the total environment, and we've ignored that. As we come to understand our ignorance, we have an obligation to do something about that. And wind energy is one of those areas where we can replace that source of energy to meet our growing demand by utilizing energy that does not put carbon into the atmosphere or destroys our water cleaning system, our filtration system for groundwater, if you will.
And I'm aware of the mercury toxicity that's associated with coal and how that's accumulating in the oceans. When I asked Johnny Weiss who was still standing tall for wind, he told me you. And in the face of what I see to be a repeat of the terrible depression that renewable energy went through in 1981, you seem, with your relationship with the tribes, to continue to keep the basics in perspective and be persevering and courageous in what are discouraging times where I see a lot of people giving up. Talk a little bit about how you personally stay strong and walk tall.
Well, it's not easy. These things take a toll on one, and you've got to be centered and I think motivated from a deep core set of values. And I appreciate Johnny Weiss's comments. He certainly is one who has stood tall for solar. But this deep understanding that is carried also in traditional ecological knowledge is the idea that everything is connected. It's an ecosystem theory, a holistic understanding that all of these things are connected. And we, through economics, tend to value one thing over another and even ignore other things if we can, as long as we can get a profit out of it. But really, for the long-term sustainability of the planet, or not the planet will be here, but sustainability of human culture, human civilization on the planet, we need to be able to take into account more than our economic systems have been doing that. And once you've had that insight, it's hard to ignore it. In fact, you have a moral responsibility not to ignore it. Aldo Leopold talks about that in San County Almanac, that those who have an ecological perspective are something like the a doctor with a dying patient, and he knows the overall problem, and he can see the likely outcome from the direction that is that the condition has been going, and you can't ignore that. You may want to comfort the patient, but the reality is that the path that they have chosen are one that's not going to be viable.
And so we're living in a time when the current course of our leadership and economy is not viable.
I think you've hit the nail on the head. And that demands for anyone who sees that to work as tirelessly as possible to make the changes necessary for our children, for our grandchildren, for the generations ahead of us unseen, and not just for the human children, but for all of Mother Earth's children, all species. Many, you know, we are living in a web of life, an ecological web of life that we've been pulling apart one strand at a time, and now we're beginning to cut things wholesale. The BP oil spill in the Gulf 2 years ago today is the epitome of our greed and our impetuous avarice for cheap oil, and we're not even burning that oil. We're not even using it. We've got technologies now that simply untap it and release it into the environment uncontrolled, doing all kinds of ecological devastation that we have no idea what the impacts of what we've already done there and what we're trying to do and what we've been trying to do to fix it using the dispersant chemicals. It just makes it smaller and more easily taken into the web of life, and we're not seeing the dollars that BP is offering to compensate, you know, the farmer, the fishermen along the Gulf, anywhere near meet the true cost of what that damage has been done.
Nobody can offer me a check that will replace my health.
Exactly. Or the health of the environment that you live in. I can't manage your health, but I can certainly work to manage a more healthy environment for all of us to live in. And that's got to be the goal and the aim that we work towards.
This is William Evans. I'm speaking with Bob Goff, Secretary of the Intertribal Council on Utility Policy. Would you say a little bit about our home, HOME?
Yes. 2 weeks ago, there was a very important conference, a gathering of peoples from North and South America, indigenous people, to discuss the rights of Mother Earth. And the conference was called ROME, the R-O, capital M-E conference, Rights of Mother Earth. And it brought together activists, indigenous activists from South America, who are involved right now in the political fight looking for ways to implement what has been put into law down there, which is a respect or a right, a program for the rights of Mother Earth. It's been put into law in Ecuador, and we are looking at the call from the indigenous peoples to begin to enforce this. How do we protect the environment, our Mother Earth, from the wanton destruction that comes from the avarice resource exploitation that's been going on in the name of cheap energy and cheap minerals and the like. So they put out a call for help, and this conference was to discuss the rights of Mother Earth and whether or not there could be political backing from the tribes or from the United States of America, from scientists, from activists. How can we organize around that concept was the purpose of the conference. And that conference brought out a number of different approaches. Some have focused on the rights of nature. Some have focused on the rights of species. Endangered species protection tries to manage the continuation and steer clear of the extinction of species through certain programs and certain environmental inquiries and adjustments made to projects. To try to manage for species misses the point that you really can't manage for an individual species. What you need to manage is the environment in which that species lives. It's a more holistic perspective. And there were some folks even critical of the rights, or seeking to ascribe rights to nature or rights to Mother Earth, because they believed, and they could demonstrate legally, how this whole system of rights comes out of a feudal, colonial and feudal system of laws that is the underpinning of legal issues in the United States and around the world, coming from the Anglo-Saxon model that got incorporated into world charters and world declarations and the United Nations and those kinds of areas. But it's a very legalistic, but a legalistic based on a whole colonial and feudal history of Western Europe. So there was criticism of the entire right model, but it is the one that we're working with. And I was asked to comment on the criticism, and I had just arrived to Kansas, where the conference was held at Haskell Indian Nations University, as part of this overall global and hemispheric discussion. I had just arrived back from several weeks at the United Nations University and the IPCC conference in Cairns, Australia. Coming back from Australia, where they happen to refer to it as Oz, and arriving in Kansas reminded some friends of mine of the end of The Wizard of Oz, where Dorothy makes it from Oz back to Kansas. So I commented that this was a very interesting discussion and that there was, as they said in that movie, no place like Rome for the rights of Mother Earth for this discussion to take place. And at the end of the conference, after listening to various perspectives, those perspectives included the rights of future generations, certainly easily understood within our own legal framework, but really not pursued. We don't have guardian ad litem who stand up for the unborn children to talk about the impacts of economic development opportunities and pursuits that we do. We don't know how to protect future generations from the consequences of our contemporary actions of something like the atomic energy plants at Fukushima. We have dangers there in Fukushima it's still ongoing as a crisis. It's off the front pages, but we still are seeing the fact that that place will be toxic for perhaps 10,000 generations into the future. Who is protecting, who is standing up for the moral consequences of our short-term economic cheap energy policy vis-a-vis the rights of those future generations to be able to enjoy a livelihood in northern Japan? No one. We that's not part of the process. But that was part of the discussion, just to give you a flavor of what was being discussed here. So at the end of the conference, we were asked and called upon to make comments, and I reflected on what I had said about there's no place like Rome, meaning the rights of Mother Earth gathering, and reflected on it in terms of what we were being asked to do. And while this conference did not bring forth another declaration of one thing or another, and we've had lots of conferences that do that, and these are important steps in a process, I think it was important that we didn't come up with some final solution, but instead put a lot of these questions on the table for discussion, for people to bring back home to their tribes, to their organizations, to their communities, and to really chew on this and think about what's at stake, and maybe we'll come up with a much stronger path towards action in service to this planet that we live on and that provides all that we need to live. So as I was reflecting on that, I was thinking about what had actually happened. And during the course of this conference, this gathering, we did hear the cries from the indigenous brothers and sisters in South America coming here saying, help our Mother Earth, help our world where we live, Pachamama, our Mother Earth, our goddess, our world, our mother world, help us because we are losing our environment. We are losing our ability to be able to provide for ourselves our sustainable ways of culture and life. So there was this cry for help our Mother Earth. And I thought about that. And I said, no, that's home. Help our Mother Earth. And this gathering was brought together, Pachamama, the Indigenous Environmental Network, and it reminded me of much of the work that was being done by groups like Honor the Earth, which doesn't really worry so much about declarations and legal authorities as much as working with local communities to build resilience and to build healthier communities and the like. So I thought honoring our Mother Earth is really what we're being called to do, and finding ways to do that. And again, honoring our Mother Earth, home. And then it struck me as there was discussion there between people who define themselves as Indigenous, and then others who are certainly Indigenous, Native Hawaiians, who said, well, Indigenous isn't just North and South America. There are Indigenous peoples in Hawaii, in Polynesia, in Asia, in Africa, and still in Europe as well. So it's not just a North and South American issue, and everyone is Indigenous to this planet, and we needed to appreciate that. So within that context, separating Indigenous Indians from non-Indians and the like, I recalled what Thomas Bianca, the very important Hopi leader who brought to the world stage the Hopi prophecies over during the last half century. I met him in the year mid-80s, early 80s in New York at the UN, and put the question to him about non-natives participating in Native culture, participating in Native spirituality, participating in Native ceremonies. And he looked and he thought about it and he said, you know, he said, when the ancestors of the people who are here today came from their countries, their mother countries, they came here with that way of life in their head and in their culture. They came with their own language and their own religion and their own customs, and that those things filled their head and their hearts, and they brought them from their old countries to this new world, this new place. And he said they couldn't hear what the spirits of this place were saying because their heads were filled with the old language and the old religion and the old cultures, the old customs, the old agricultural ways from some other place. They couldn't really fully appreciate what was here. He said, but maybe over generations, maybe you no longer hold those languages. Maybe you can no longer speak French or German or whatever your historical origins may have, Irish, whatever. Maybe you don't practice that same religion that they did. Maybe you're not carrying that old country here. And maybe you can listen. And he said that it was really important because hearing what Mother Earth has to say is a way to then take the appropriate steps and directions for what's right here. And he said, the spirits of this place will speak to anyone who will listen. That's what he told me. The spirits of this place will speak to anyone who will listen. So it is our responsibility to listen and our responsibility to hear our Mother Earth. And again, hear our Mother Earth. Home. We need to take care of this place. And how do we take care of it? Well, we can argue about declarations, we can argue about fine points of the law, we can argue about legal histories, or we can work in the direction, clarified and understood, better understood, work in the direction of what we can do to heal our Mother Earth. So again, the call to action, it seemed to me, was it is one of healing our Mother Earth. And again, that's home. We need to work through these areas, work through these issues in a way for the health of our Mother Earth, and really bring our energies through dogma, through histories, through culture, to a point of listening and hearing what our Mother Earth has to say, and working towards healing her in this process. So it struck me that, you know, we are non-divided in the sense that we are all here on this planet. This is our home, and we need to do what we can to help and honor, hear, and heal this place where we live that supports us.
This is William Evans. I'm speaking with Bob Goff, Secretary of the Intertribal Council on Utility Policy, KU. We're grateful, Bob. Thank you for reminding us of the basics and the example of courage and continuing to follow the path of health and harmony with the gift we've been given in a time of great confusion.
It's been my honor to do so.
You're listening to KDNK. Thank you for listening.
Thank you for the opportunity to speak.
Hope. Oh.